There are places on the map where the road ends. It can be easy to forget that. I drove to what you might call the end of the roads once. Started here in New Hampshire, we drove first 4 hours north to Montreal. That's where the big yellow roads, the closed access highways, the interstates, that's where those end. But then we kept going. Another 7 hours straight north to Matagami. That's where the highways built by the normal processes of government end, and a road built by a process of colonial corporate expansion began. And then we drove another 10 hours through the low black spruce trees that fight their way up from the thin soils of the Canadian Shield to Chisasibi, a thriving Cree town at 53 degrees north latitude. There's another road that goes east that we could have driven along for longer, but to get to the next village up the coast, we would have had to have gone by boat or plane or snowmobile. It felt like we had driven to the end of the roads. Today I want to tell you about another place on the map where the road ends.
The agreement signed today by Secretary of Transportation Volpe, Panamanian Minister of Public Works Fabrega, and Colombian Minister...
In English, we call it the Darien Gap. In Spanish, it's called El Tapón del Darién, or the Darien Plug.
The Darien Gap, needed to link together existing sections of the Pan-American highway system.
This is not Richard Nixon you're hearing, by the way. It's my coworker Nick Capodice very convincingly reading a written statement Nixon made in 1971 about the completion of a 14,000-mile road from Alaska to the tip of South America.
The completion of the Darien Gap portion over the next several years will constitute an historic milestone along the road to understanding and unity within our hemisphere.
The Darien has been many things to many people. In the late 1600s, Scotland, of all countries, made one of its attempts at colonialism by sending 5 ships to the Darien coast. This obviously didn't work out. It's now alternately called the Darien Scheme or the Darien Fiasco. Drivers have taken the Darien Gap as a challenge. The fact that this space has defied the dominance of roads seems to attract them. The first time a Jeep managed to drive the whole way, it took fully 2 years. One publicity stunt meant to literally sell Chevys resulted in a Chevy Corvair being permanently abandoned in the rainforest of the Darien.
For a long time, experts thought that this section could not be built. The bottomless Atrato swamp which it must cross could not be conquered. The fact that this project will now be undertaken is a tribute, not only to modern engineering, but also to the determination of our countries to forge this final link in a great unifying international project.
From a Globetrotter's perspective, today the Darien seems to exist mostly as an obstacle to tourists who want to drive from Alaska to Tierra del Fuego. You can read about 1,000 travel bloggers who have written nearly identical tales about taking the boat around it. Despite Nixon's sunny outlook, it has never been completed. Though now, the Darien Gap is only some 40-ish miles wide. What is a place that defies roads? A wilderness?
You know, right at the edge of two continents, right? You know, where North America ends and South America begins.
A swamp.
It's unbelievable. You're standing in the middle there and you're surrounded by mosquitoes. There's clouds and clouds of them. There's nothing you can do.
A crucible.
Muchísima gente, pues, ha quedado ahí en el Darien.
A refuge?
The roads bring with them loggers, miners, farmers, development.
This is Outside In, a show about the natural world and how we use it. Today on the show, El Tapón del Darien. A place that has defied roads despite more than a century of efforts to build one. But roadlessness does not mean no one is there. What happens and what does not happen in a place without roads? I want you to consider this place through 3 frames. And the first frame is through the eyes of the coyote.
So if they survive through the Darien, plug, as we call it in Colombia, I think they could become an invasive species very quickly.
And to kind of start with the punchline here, the Darien is the last thing standing between the coyote and basically all of South America.
This is a process that could take several hundred years, but we could well see coyotes down to in the southern tips of Argentina.
This is Jorge, by the way.
Yeah, my name is Jorge Ahumada, and I'm a senior wildlife conservation scientist at Conservation International.
Jorge is from Colombia, just below the Darien Gap. And Jorge has done a lot of research with a very specific scientific tool.
Camera traps.
Cameras that you strap to a tree and which go off automatically when something walks by. It was really only in the last, 10 years that these became cheap enough to become a ubiquitous scientific tool.
So, I mean, a lot of these animals, you don't see them. I mean, they're there, but because they're so rare. So the beauty of camera traps is, you know, they catch these things very easily. And if you put enough of them in a forest, in a protected area, you will get, you know, 90, 95, 96% of all the mammals, you know, that dwell on the floor.
Which, prior to camera traps, was a very difficult thing to do. One quick camera trap tangent here. Once in the pre-camera trap days, back when studying animal behaviors meant chasing them around with binoculars, Jorge saw something in a rainforest in Colombia.
And I thought, what is this? I mean, looked like a little dog with little ears and a stubbed tail. And so I went back to the camp and I told everybody I saw this animal and everybody was looking at me like I'm crazy.
It wasn't until 25-ish years later that Jorge realized he had been one of a very few people to observe a very rare species that is mostly found east of the Andes in Brazil, a species which you should absolutely Google because it's adorable, called a bush dog.
I was like, that's the...
I saw this.
25 years, it was like pumping the air, you know, yes.
The reason I'm telling you all this is because camera traps are how we know that coyotes are about to cross into South America. I don't have video on my end, but I appreciate your video because I get to see that you've got a wall covered with strange implements back there.
That's right. That's my Skype background. That's my those are my gardening tools.
This is Roland Kays, a professor at North Carolina State University and a coyote researcher of the most swashbuckling kind.
Is that actually true? They look like a couple bow and arrows back there.
Yeah, well, you know, sometimes you get harassed while you're guarding. No, yeah, it's just stuff I've collected.
So the postcard version of the history of coyotes is that they're native to North America, but they weren't always so widespread.
Yeah, so coyotes were in the western United States, Canada, and Mexico. They were in sort of drier, more open country. So pretty widespread across that area in grasslands, savannas, deserts, and more open woodlands.
Coyotes are amazingly adaptable. They eat whatever. They'll eat deer if they can get it, but also little stuff. Mice, rabbits, your cat.
And they can also handle a fair amount of fruit and insects. So some of the animals down here in North Carolina eat a lot of their diet is insects and fruit throughout the year.
When you say fruit, are we talking apples?
Well, sure, if there's apples, they'd love some apples. down here, it was a lot of persimmon.
Okay.
Which, you know, in New England, there's probably going to be less fruit, but certainly blueberries are big for them during a certain time of year.
And unlike, say, wolves, they have a ton of pups, and they have more when food is abundant.
You know, if it's a good year, if there's lots of food around, there can all of a sudden, you know, two animals can make 15 animals or 12 animals or whatever it was.
And all of those pups, when they're born, they head off trying to find a new territory.
And that's one of the reasons they're so hard to get rid of or control or limit their populations. Because anytime you remove one, if it's a breeder, you know, three or four more are going to come in and try to take their place. But if you keep removing these coyotes, you're basically you're creating a vacuum. It's sucking in all these coyotes from the surrounding countryside that are out there looking for an opening.
In the pre-colonial days, anywhere there was forest, wolves and mountain lions kept coyotes out. But then we killed huge numbers of wolves and mountain lions, and in the 1900s, coyotes started to move into their place.
Yeah, well, so they really moved in all directions.
North, into Alaska.
Through the Yukon and into Alaska, and that's the one we actually don't know very much about. That hasn't been well studied.
They moved into the temperate rainforests of the Northwest. They colonized the whole East Coast, which used to be very wolfy and mountain lion-y. But they also moved south.
Yeah, so they move south pretty quickly. Apparently, it's not super well documented, but when a new animal like a coyote, shows up in Costa Rica or Panama, people notice it. It seemed like they crossed the Panama Canal, I think it was around 2010.
If you're asking yourself how they crossed the Panama Canal, we have no idea how.
And so we went down in 2015, we wanted to kind of see, okay, well, where are they? How far have they gotten? Because it's not too far from the Panama Canal to South America. And so we ran a transect of cameras from Panama City, basically, towards an area called the Darién, and it's literally where the Pan-American Highway ends.
El Tapón del Darién, the quote-unquote bottomless swamp that Rhodes never quote-unquote conquered. That last unfragmented forest that can still support jaguars, who don't treat coyotes very well. Roland says they've seen plenty of coyotes in the ranch lands leading up to the Darién, but so far they've only seen two in their camera traps actually in the Darién forest. Roland calls those on the leading edge of the spreading population dispersers.
The wave of colonization has made it about halfway to an area called Lago Bayano. It's a big dammed lake. But there's these dispersers that are out in front looking for other coyotes, and they're not going to find any because there's none there, but there are, and they're right. So they are now, at least two coyotes have been found in the Darién province, right kind of at the footstep of South America.
But the Darién is different from every other area that the coyotes have moved through so far. They do best around the edges that we create. They ride the cresting wave of disturbed forests, ranch lands. Suburban sprawl opens up the land to them. But the Darién is a national park. It's a UNESCO World Heritage Biosphere Reserve. It's miles and miles of unfragmented jungle.
It could be a little bit more hairy for them if coyotes run into this environment. They might get attacked by jaguars or by other cats that already live there. There's pumas there too. Certainly could take coyotes down.
This is not the only time the Darién Gap has served as a kind of ecological barrier. Occasional outbreaks of foot and mouth disease in South America have meant that North and Central American cattle ranchers have been very glad to have a forest full of jaguars separating the continents. And for decades, the U.S. and Panama have collaborated on an effort to keep a horrifying flesh-eating parasite out of North America by airdropping millions of sterilized screwworms over the Darién Gap, a kind of wall of infertility in the wilderness. And so now, the whole world is watching. Well, in certain circles. Specifically, researchers like Jorge Ahumada, ones who run camera traps on the Colombian side of the Darién, are watching. But, more metaphorically, the rest of us are too. Waiting to see if this versatile little canine that has already conquered North America, often despite our efforts to flat out exterminate them with hunting and poison, will spread through South America too. With all of the ecological fallout that might entail. When a mesopredator makes its debut in an ecosystem, the results can be cascading. The classic example is house cats, which have contributed to the extinction of somewhere between 30 and 60 species worldwide. It is also possible that the coyotes won't be disastrous, at least at first. Colombia is one of the most diverse places in the world, and the coyote might have a hard time proliferating. They might just wind up skulking around the edges of towns, competing with stray dogs. We don't know what will happen. Both Roland and Jorge think coyotes will make it through, in part because another species already has, a South American species. The crab-eating fox already made it north into Panama. Roland and Jorge say the fox probably skirted up the coast, walking along beaches where it could to make the journey less dangerous. And the coyote could do the same in the opposite direction. But still, the Darién is the coyote's last obstacle to the south. Jorge knows all the researchers running camera traps on the Colombian side.
Well, I guess that was one of my questions, is how confident are we that they will be detected? Like, are there a lot of camera traps right now in these forests?
No.
No, okay.
No. No, it will be a shot in the dark,
Yeah.
You only need a pair to go through to start it, right? So it will be a pretty rare event.
If you wanted it to be, this could be the story of the Darien Gap, the ecological bulwark, the last barrier keeping coyotes from colonizing all of South America. We could then move on for the rest of this episode to Jorge talking about whether or not he thinks it's actually likely that a species like the coyote would result in some sort of ecological disaster.
If you look at where invasive species have been most successful, is usually in islands where there's not a lot of diversity. But here you're facing...
We could hear from Roland Kays again about what might happen to coyotes' genetics in South America when the first few make it through and have no other coyotes to breed with.
You know, a coyote breeds with a dog, it's 50-50, coyote, 50 dog. And then as they breed with more dogs, then it would be more dog and less coyote.
That's all interesting stuff. But is that the story of the Darien? More after a break.
Sí, pues, tengo... hermanas, tengo primos, tengo primas, tengo tíos.
This is Justin Pascal Dubisson. He's from Haiti, but is currently living in Florida, waiting to hear about his pending asylum application. While he waits, he's started a YouTube channel, news and commentary directed at a Haitian audience. He came to the U.S., because he has family here.
Sí, sí. Cada haitiano que está ahí en Haití tiene por lo menos una familia aquí en Estados Unidos. Y yo tengo demasiado.
In fact, he says he has too much family here in the U.S. There's a chance that if you've heard of the Darien, it's because you've heard about it through the context of people like Pascal. He was one of tens of thousands of migrants, many from Haiti, but also Africa, who made their way overland through Central America to the U.S. border in 2016. He wrote a book about the experience called Sobrevivientes. I asked him,
¿Cuál fue el parte más difícil? Es que el
of that whole trip, what was the hardest part?
No, fue el Darien.
He said it was the Darien Gap, because in the Darien, you felt your life was not completely safe, which feels like an understatement. In the first story, the Darien is an untrammeled wilderness, a biodiversity hotspot, a sanctuary for jaguars and endangered species. In the second story, the Darien is a liminal space occupied by extra-legal personalities. One 2010 Reuters headline screams, Panama's Darien teems with FARC drug runners. Pascal says his trip through the Darien started with a boat ride from Turbo, Colombia, across the Gulf of Urubá, ending in the famous bottomless Atrato swamp.
Como en este momento lo hemos pagado como $30.
He was traveling with several hundred others because numbers brought safety. When he landed in the Darien, they were met by coyotes. That's the name in Spanish for people who are engaged in smuggling people across the border. Coyotes.
Depende. Si el grupo tiene 100 personas, te pueden pedir 20 o 15, $30 por persona.
He says the guides don't really guide you. If you walk too slow, they left you behind. They simply walked at the head of the group to show the way. The first night, the guides brought them to a little bar, a little store in the middle of the jungle where they sold beer and rum and cigarettes and played dance music. And it was there that Pascal first experienced the Darien's infamous rain.
I mean, the Darien is just like one of the most rainy places in the world.
That's Jorge Ahumada again.
I think it's like 13 meters of rain a year or something like that.
I struggled to verify that fact, but it's not wildly out of sync with what I could find. The third rainiest city in the world is Tutunedo, a city in the nearby rainforests of northern Colombia. And there, it rains more than 11 meters a year.
Here you have like mountains combined with a lot of rain, combined with a lot of mud, and that gives you a lot of mosquitoes and a lot of other things. I mean, it's just like very difficult to go through. It's unbelievable. You're standing in the middle there and you're surrounded by mosquitoes. It's like there's clouds and clouds of them. There's nothing you can do about it.
cada noche estuvo lloviendo.
Pascal says it rained so hard that first night, sleeping next to the bar, that he basically never slept. The first full day of walking started at 5 a.m. He says they were walking in rubber boots they had bought after hearing about the mud. And that first day, they climbed up a slippery mountain trail that took 8 hours to reach the high point.
Ooh.
He says that many in their group didn't make it to the second night's camp on the other side of that climb until after dark.
Ooh, hermano.
And when they did try to bed down, next to a river, it rained again.
Y una persona, nos gritó que...
Someone shouted that the river was rising, and they all scrambled in the middle of the night for high ground.
A subir de nuevo a la montaña.
After 2 full days of walking, Pascal and his group were delivered to a camp that had been set up by the Panamanian military to process the thousands of migrants that were crossing the Darién. They were still in the jungle, and it would be another week of waiting in a series of military camps, of wading across small rivers and floating downstream in improvised rafts before they finally emerged in a town on the other side. Pascal had gotten a cut on his foot that was badly infected by that time, but he made it. Many don't. I couldn't find an estimate of deaths in the Darién, and I read in Spanish language press reports that no estimate exists. But I found plenty of accounts, just like Pascal's, that make it clear that people do die. And it's not just death. Again, it's hard to find precise numbers, but sexual violence, especially against women and LGBTQ migrants along the route, is quite common.
Están como ellos están usando a la naturaleza en contra nosotros.
He says, not completing the road is like using nature against migrants. It's like using the jungle as a wall.
Y funcionó porque muchísima gente pues ha quedado ahí en el Darién.
And he says, it works. Many people have died crossing the Darién. In the United States, it's been well documented that it was an actual federal policy to push migrants onto ever more dangerous routes, through deserts, over mountains, across rivers. In the U.S., this has resulted in thousands, perhaps tens of thousands of deaths. There are many reasons why the Pan American Highway was never finished. And not building a road is not quite so deliberate an action as choosing to build a wall. And Panamanian government officials have not been so blatant as to say, we're not building a road because we don't want immigrants from the south. But whether it's deliberately meant to be or not, the Darién is an ordeal that looms large in the minds of those who make plans to walk north. In this second story, the lack of a road through the Darién is a humanitarian crisis, fueling crime and death. What the first story makes seem like an unspoiled wilderness, in the second story is home to guerrillas, backwoods bars, and is spiderwebbed with illicit trails.
Recuerdo que cuando se hace la creación de la República de Panamá con la República de Colombia, existían las comunidades fronterizas.
This is Héctor Huertas, one of Panama's indigenous Guna people, and an attorney who represents the 7 indigenous communities in the country. He says, when the borders of South America were drawn on the map by Spanish colonials, some of those communities were carved up by those new borders, like the communities living inside the Darién.
De ahí que la existencia de caminos culturales han sido utilizados por los migrantes para pasar por el área.
So when migrants and those who profit off of them began to pass through the Darién, there were trails already. What in both the first and second stories was empty wilderness, a national park, a UNESCO biodiversity preserve visited occasionally by drug runners and human traffickers, was and is occupied. There are around 10,000 of the Emberá Wunan people scattered throughout 2 dozen villages in the Darién. And it is precisely this fact that has allowed this liminal place to continue to exist. Let me explain. The idea of connecting the Americas via one massive transportation network has been around since the heyday of the rail building days, just after the Civil War. But the impulse to build a giant highway to serve the commercial interests of the United States has been implicit in how American presidents have seen Central America since Teddy Roosevelt's big stick diplomacy. In English, this phrase is funny. It's kind of a punchline. But in Spanish, they call it
La política del garrote.
La política del garrote. If you don't speak Spanish, just trust me. It sounds way more sinister when you're on the other end of the stick. But even so, it was slow going. It never hurt that Panama did not have a huge incentive to complete the highway, since most of its trade was going north, and they already had a road going in that direction.
Teníamos científicos norteamericanos que combatieron con la fiebre aftosa.
Hector says in the 1970s, despite the brave pronouncements of Nixon that we heard at the beginning, North American scientists recommended against opening El Tapón del Darién.
Recomendaron que eso no se podía abrir todavía.
They were afraid that outbreaks of foot and mouth disease that had been seen in Venezuela, Ecuador, and Colombia would spread north if there was a highway. They wanted to protect the North American cattle industry. This bought time for the indigenous movement to gather steam. In 1983, the Emberá-Wunan people were given control of their comarca, what we in the United States would call a reservation. And that comarca,
que precisamente hace un cordón por todo el Darién,
formed a cordon, a blockade, if you will, across the Darién Gap, right across where the Pan American Highway was being planned. Of course, infrastructure projects have been built through indigenous lands without ever really asking permission before, and this time, too, it looked like that was set to happen. The Inter-American Development Bank had set aside the financing to complete the highway. Panama and Colombia formed a Good Neighbors Commission whose principal goal was to finish it. The political window had opened. But something happened.
Estuvo una compañera norteamericana por aquí, Alicia Corte.
Hector says a North American woman named Alicia Corden started to travel around to indigenous communities inside the Darién, telling them about the coming road.
My name is Alicia Corden.
And here she is.
And I run a company called The Culture Company. And I lived in Panama for a few years, from 93 to 1996.
Alicia spent years going between the dozens of communities that would be affected by the highway. She says the deeper into the Darién you get, the more the families there are still living a traditional lifestyle, dependent on the rainforest.
When I came into the region, you can see exactly what the highway does. So I started in this bus where everything I saw on the right and left of the road that I was on was denuded. It was burned and denuded. So the rainforest starts where the road stops. And the roads bring with them loggers, miners, farmers, development.
When you look at a map, you might see that much of the Darién Gap is designated a national park. But national parks are complicated. They're often created as a result of top-down initiatives, driven and financed by international interest groups. They're sometimes plunked on top of communities that don't want them. Sometimes governments themselves don't sustain much interest in enforcing the park's protections. And in the case of the Darién, that is left up to the indigenous people who live there. So according to Hector, it was less the protected status of the land and more the financing that brought the project to a halt.
Se planteó en Washington.
Hector says the loans for the road came from the World Bank and the Inter-American Development Bank, or IDB, and they were given with certain contingencies about human rights, about indigenous title to indigenous land.
Antes no se legalizaban las tierras indígenas.
Which meant that when the bulldozers started to roll in the late 90s, there was a fully unified indigenous movement ready to call foul.
And so then that was the moment that they were like, okay, sound the alarms, you know? And so then the Sierra Club and World Wildlife Fund and a whole bunch of different environmental players now kind of descended on the IDB and said, hey, you know, we have this resolution from, you know, 5 indigenous congresses in Panama saying that they don't want this project and it's in violation of these regulations and what's going on. And so everything, you know, kind of like started moving really quickly at that point. And the bulldozers actually got pulled back out and the project stopped.
After that, the political window of opportunity seems to have closed. So far, the Panamanian government has shown no interest, of late, in again taking up the fight to build a road through El Tapón del Darién. So what is this place without roads? This place that, judging by a Google search of its name, mostly figures in people's imaginations as the one remaining impediment to a truly epic road trip. The thing I like about my job, about getting to make this show, is that in talking to the people that I did for this story, I went through the same journey that hopefully I just walked you all through. I personally started picturing the Darién Gap as a spotless rainforest and ended with it as part of a broad story of indigenous resistance. At first, it was a tapón, a plug, separating the biota and the people of North and South America. But I finished seeing it as part of an interconnected geography, a rainforest filled with people defending their way of life. This story began describing another place where, looking on a map, it looks like the end of a road in Canada, past Montreal, past Matagami, through the spruce trees and into the taiga, the Cree town of Chisasibi. But while most roads might stop there, human movement does not, whether by air or by river or by ocean. In many ways, winter opens up the land there even more by blanketing the underbrush with snow to slide over. So the Arctic tundra is not empty. And of course, neither is the Darién Gap. These places without roads are not blank spaces on a map. They aren't anomalies waiting to be corrected. A road is a way of moving, but really it's just one way to get somewhere.
That was Sam Evans Brown on the Darién Gap. Up next on Outside In, the power of maps.
And I'm realizing like a lot of the opportunities that I did not have access to, a lot of it is tied to like just boundaries.
That's coming up after the break. This is Outside In, a show about the natural world and how we use it. I'm Justine Paradise. We just heard a story produced by Sam Evans Brown about the Darién Gap, a stretch of rainforest at the edge of Central and South America that figures large in the imagination, partly because it's a place without roads. But this got us wondering, why does it feel so surprising or even just interesting that a place would be roadless or uncharted? And this got us thinking about maps. Picture a map. Really, take a second. Maybe a map of wherever you are right now. If you're listening to my voice on the radio, perhaps you're somewhere in New Hampshire or nearby. Okay, picture that map. What's on it? Maybe rivers? Perhaps the Merrimack and Connecticut River? Maybe the White Mountains? Maybe 89 and 93 or the different highways in your area? What are the boundaries? What is not on the map? And what is this map for? Is it to guide you as you navigate, or to help you get somewhere? Or is it to do something else? To keep track of the tree species growing in the area? Or perhaps the purpose is to chart the underlying geology? Or perhaps a map exists to tell you about one specific event, a particular moment in time, like a battle or a protest. Maybe it's to communicate real-time data, like the weather, or where are the COVID cases in the state. A map can do many things. If you were to draw a map that communicated the story of your life, what would you include? Would the neighborhood bodega make it in? The berry patch you used to go to with your parents? Your best friend's apartment? What would you leave out? Maps are representations of the world, and therefore are inherently incomplete, and sometimes grossly inaccurate. just starting from the basic fact that the world is round. A map, unless it's a globe, is flat. And a two-dimensional map is always a distorted representation of the world.
The surface of a sphere cannot be represented as a plane without some form of distortion. That was mathematics.
There's kind of a whole genre of YouTube explainer videos about this, specifically about map projections, about how people get the sphere of the world to translate to the flat surface of a map.
And here's the big problem. Every one of these projections comes with trade-offs in shape, distance, direction, and land area. Certain map projections...
The Mercator projection is a famous and famously inaccurate example. Well, it does maintain some accuracy in the relative relationships and shapes of different continents. It is absolutely terrible when it comes to size. It's pretty accurate, again, close to the equator, but not so much when you get to the poles, as explained in this episode of The West Wing.
Why are we changing maps?
Because, CJ, the Mercator projection has fostered European imperialist attitudes for centuries and created an ethnic bias against the Third World.
Really?
With the Mercator projection, a map of the world shows Greenland to be about the size of Africa, when in reality, Africa is some 14 times bigger. Gerardus Mercator, the Flemish cartographer who developed what's now known as the Mercator projection, created it for navigational purposes.
The map enlarges areas at the poles to create straight lines of constant bearing or geographic direction.
So it makes it easier to cross an ocean.
The Mercator projection is also used for Google Maps. Probably for this reason, that it's good for navigation. So a projection is a big decision, but everything on a map is a decision. I invite you to go back to the map you pictured, to those rivers and valleys and roads and mountains and borders, and ask, what are the names of the places on the map? Are they written in English? Who named them and when? When were those borders drawn? Does everyone accept those borders, use those names? Even if the purpose of the map is simply to provide directions, a map also communicates a lot about its maker. And sometimes the maker and the purpose can have a big impact.
I will be the first to say, like, in elementary school, when I was learning about maps, I did not enjoy the classes at all. And often because it was focused on, like, people like Christopher Columbus or, you know, other Eurocentric travelers who discovered places. And so I guess I never saw myself as a part of that narrative.
That's Latoya Gray Sparks. She's a graduate student at Virginia Commonwealth University studying urban and regional planning.
My focus will be in historic preservation, cultural preservation, as well as it pertains to the African American community. And I love mapping. So that's what I do a lot in my spare time.
In your spare time?
Yes. Not that I have a lot of it, but yeah.
Plus, for the last 3 years, Latoya served on the advisory council of Richmond 300, working on the City of Richmond's 2020 comprehensive plan.
When I was beginning my tenure on Richmond 300, I didn't know anything about urban planning, so I definitely had to catch up. But I have a background in history, so I certainly used that to my advantage.
But it was at these Richmond 300 meetings where she started recognizing the impact of urban planning and some of the patterns on the map that were being used to shape the vision for the city.
One of the questions we were asked to ponder is why we have concentrated poverty in the city of Richmond. And the concentrated pockets of poverty are in the East End and parts of the South Side.
And the way Latoya approached that question was informed not only by her background in history, but also her own personal story. Latoya grew up on the south side of Richmond.
Something I learned just last week is that the area that I lived in is annexed land. So it used to be a part of Chesterfield County.
Chesterfield County, that's the county beyond the James River, just to the southwest of the city.
And during the 1970s, there were white politicians who I guess felt they were growing fearful of how powerful the Black political class was becoming. So in order to counter that, they added this big chunk of Chesterfield County.
What this annexation did was change the city's demographics. With the stroke of a pen, the city's population dropped from 52% Black to 42%.
Which increased white power and the white population immensely.
This was very controversial and, in fact, even went to the U.S. Supreme Court. But ultimately, for Latoya's neighborhood, it had lasting effects.
So that was in the 1970s, and I'm realizing a lot of the opportunities that I did not have access to, or the reason that the South Side had just been hurting is because that it was added like as a part of like power play and then just kind of forgotten and isolated for quite some time. So I guess growing up, like I was aware, like our schools were not wonderful. The crime rate was pretty high and, you know, just a lot of economic depression and whatnot. And a lot of it is tied to like just boundaries being changed and shifted. Being introduced to that visual data kind of confirmed what I already suspected, that like I was in an underprivileged part of town, but like I also found that the perspective was often like from a white lens, you know. So I just began to think that like there needs to be like another narrative introduced. And as someone who's been like a victim of redlining and other, you know, discriminatory mapping practices, like there's a narrative that I can introduce that people may not have been aware of.
For instance, one of Richmond 300's ideas was to increase density in the city to accommodate anticipated growth. And in fact, LaToya remembers one map that was being presented early on during the process that represented Richmond during the 1950s.
And it was showing the density that we once had in the downtown area. So on one hand, like that map was being presented as like, this is what the great stuff that we are, you know, capable of, you know, we can bring this density back. But I felt like there was a narrative, again, that was missing. Like the reason that that area was so dense is because Black people who lived in that area during the time of Jim Crow could not live anywhere else within the city. So it was dense because they were kind of concentrated into this area.
It wasn't just redlining, which is a discriminatory practice of refusing loans to people living in certain neighborhoods, which often means people of color, and often prevented Black people from borrowing money and thus from obtaining property. LaToya also read about housing segregation in books like The Color of the Law and about the history behind housing projects in the city.
And I found that a lot of it was rooted in these maps created by Harlan Bartholomew.
Harlan Bartholomew was a city planner
who mapped many places across this country.
He worked for the city of St. Louis and had his own firm. And he was also appointed to federal positions by Presidents Hoover, Roosevelt, and Eisenhower. Bartholomew worked on 6,000 projects and created plans for over 500 cities, including Richmond.
His urban planning maps certainly impacted the way that Richmond is structured. A great deal of the African-American population was located in the downtown area. And if I'm understanding my history right, there was this big movement called the City Beautiful Movement within the urban planning profession that targeted urban centers because they were crowded. There was a lot of density and there were slums in those areas.
The City Beautiful movement originated in the 1890s, and it was hugely influential. So if you view it generously, Bartholomew envisioned a more livable city, which to him meant decentralization.
So the City Beautiful movement was meant to like decentralize the downtown areas, incorporate green spaces. So that is something positive that came out of that movement. But it also meant that the people who were packed in those areas, often people of color and immigrants as well, like they had to be displaced. So that planning process introduced, like for Richmond, the Richmond Redevelopment Housing Authority, which was tasked with using eminent domain to like compel people to court who were like behind in taxes or whatever. And the taxes would be the equivalent of like $100 today. And if they weren't able to pay that amount, then their land was declared blighted and then eligible for the city to buy and then turn over to private developers or keep. And so that was the way, that was the mechanism that was used like to clear away that property. And it was all rooted like in the plan implemented and created by Harlan Bartholomew. And so if you combine that with the redlining maps, it just tells a story of how places and blocks were targeted, where Black people lived. And then even if there were like thriving communities and whatnot, they were deemed as blighted because of the presence of Black people. And so the land was devalued and then designated for slum clearance, which of course led to the construction of highways through downtown areas.
And so when LaToya saw that map of the density of the downtown back in the 50s,
that map bugged me to death.
She eventually put together a project called Planned Destruction.
And all I wanted to do was like create some kind of redlining layer to put over top of it to prove my point.
A brief history on land ownership, valuation, and development in the city of Richmond, and the maps used to destroy Black communities.
Which I did, but then I realized I could do other things as well, so.
The project laid out some of this history, but it's really best experienced visually. LaToya layered that redlining map over geographic data of the contemporary Black and white residents in the city, plus property value, poverty rates, and median household income.
But we are essentially still living in those patterns, and I think there are efforts to get away from that, but as the civil unrest that we experienced over the summer indicates, like this is, we have like a long way to go in untangling all of that.
Plus, as the effects of climate change intensify, increasingly frequent and severe heat waves can disproportionately affect certain zip codes, often zip codes that overlap with areas shaped by redlining, or where access to green space is more limited. Back in the 40s, Harlan Bartholomew would call the areas where Black people were living blighted, or slums. And during her work with Richmond 300, as they were developing new maps, LaToya recalls that she saw that certain areas were being labeled as established or non-established. And these definitions felt familiar.
I found that the non-established neighborhoods were pretty much where people of color lived or lower class people lived. And I was afraid of that language. Like, it sounds nicer than slum and blighted, but it could serve as like a signal to developers of, hey, this is where cheap property or inexpensive property is that you can like plot or develop, and it would lead to like the displacement of the current residents. So I spoke up about that. I was kind of nervous because I was like, I hope like I get my point across and I don't sound too frustrated or angry, but thankfully that language is not being used on our maps and hopefully will not return. But just, you know, just the defining of spaces, like I think is offensive to the people who live in those spaces, who are doing the best that they can, you know, with the community and the resources that they have. So I guess I felt like I was hopefully standing up for them.
As for what's next for LaToya, right now she's got an eye on Pine Grove, a historic, predominantly Black community in Charles City County, a place where Booker T. Washington started a school and where a massive landfill is now being proposed.
The way that I want to help is like just create maps that help to enforce like the historic or reaffirm, I guess, the historic significance of this place and why a landfill would not be appropriate in the area.
Mm. So using a map to sort of demonstrate the place's value.
Yes, yes. And hopefully like also, I guess, like as I've done with the downtown Richmond area, like just tell a story.
And LaToya is interested in stories that have gone untold in Richmond and the Commonwealth of Virginia more largely, especially stories about how urban renewal impacted the Black community.
I guess I had no idea like just how big of a deal urban planning is. So it's given me a greater appreciation for the process, but I also realized that a lot of people who should be incorporated or in this process, just they don't know about it. So I will spend the rest of my days just trying to educate people and encourage people to pay attention to what's happening to their communities.
That was LaToya Gray Sparks. You can find her on Twitter at LaToya S. Gray. We'll also put links to her project Planned Destruction on the episode post on nhpr.org.
Outside In was produced this week by me, Sam Evans-Brown, with help from Justine Paradise and Taylor Quimby. Erica Janik is our executive producer. Maureen McMurray is director of our Coyote Fancy Fan Club. If you're interested in a very detailed history of the Pan American Highway and how it came to be that the Darien Gap has been preserved, there's a book you should check out. It's called The Longest Line on the Map, The United States, the Pan American Highway, and the Quest to Link the Americas. Special thanks to its author, Eric Rutko. Special thanks also to Pedro Mendez of the University of Panama and to Ross Irwin of Humanizando la Deportación. If you love the show, there are many ways to stay in touch. We are on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. Find us by searching at Outside In Radio. And we have a newsletter which you can subscribe to as well at our website, outsideinradio.org. And remember, we are a public radio show. We depend on donations to make this all happen. You can give online at our website as well. Music in this episode by Blue Dot Sessions. Our theme music is by Breakmaster Cylinder. Outside In is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.